Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And on our show today, we'll be talking with Dr. Reed Blackwater, president of the American Academy of Family Physicians, about being a family physician in the 21st century. I'm really excited to have a conversation with Dr. Blackwater, someone who I knew as a resident many years ago, who really has risen to the national leadership position for our discipline.
Yeah, well, and we have some intimate experience about this now, but it's exciting to talk with a leader who's really also looking forward.
Yeah, you know, speaking of kind of looking forward, I'm looking forward to some of the research we're about to talk about on research that matters. We're going to be talking about should doctors and are they asking about secondhand smoke when patients are admitted for heart problems to the hospital?
And recommendations from doctors for methods for swallowing pills.
About two research articles about diabetes and about obesity, some things that can help us maybe lose weight and also be more motivated to lose weight, both that are good things.
Yeah, and some research showing that obesity might shorten life expectancy for up to 8 years. So that makes the former research about diabetes and losing weight even more important.
Let's talk about the very first research that matters, Christy, about something that's very near and dear to me, but also all doctors and I think a lot of patients, which is when you're admitted to the hospital and you're admitted, let's say, for chest pain or onto a cardiac unit, do the doctors ask you about any exposure to secondhand smoke? And does that matter?
Right. And so not all heart disease patients know that secondhand smoke is bad for them. And so all the more reason that we should be talking with patients about this. And, you know, it's one of those things that is standard for pediatric patients to ask about secondhand smoke, but maybe not in the repertoire of doctors to routinely ask about secondhand smoke in adults.
Yeah, this research was actually published in the Journal of the American Medical Association's Internal Medicine. It was actually done by Dr. Nancy Rigotti, actually a colleague of mine up at Mass General Hospital, a great researcher. And for this study, she looked at 214 adults who were hospitalized for coronary heart disease at Massachusetts General Hospital and then asked them, you know, how many of you have been exposed to secondhand smoke? And then how many of you were asked about it by your doctors? And of the 20% who said they had been exposed to secondhand smoke within a month of coming in, which actually is a major risk factor for heart disease, only a fraction of them really had been asked about their secondhand smoke exposure or remembered being asked by a doctor or a nurse since that hospital admission. Less than 20%.
I think it really highlights both to medical providers and hospitals to be more systematic in the things that we talk about, but also just want to put a shout out to our patients that that secondhand smoke and even thirdhand smoke can cause dangers. You want to explain what thirdhand smoke is since I just tossed that out there?
Yeah, thirdhand smoke is that residue that occurs from someone who's smoking tobacco products that are lit, and it's the residue of the tar and those products that are on your clothes and on your fabric of the car and the furniture that actually have cancer-causing agents that you're exposed to, even if you're a non-smoker coming into contact with someone who has those residues.
Yep. So now we're going to talk about swallowing pills, shifting gears a little bit, talking about swallowing pills. So I don't know about you, Adam, but I have a lot of patients, and I think about even people in my family who say, you know, I have a really hard time. I can't take my medicines because they're hard to swallow or have to have all these creative ways to be able to get all these pills down.
You know, Christy, I had a patient recently who unfortunately swallowed a pill the wrong way, and the patient, you know, in their 70s, who actually ended up in the emergency room because the pill got caught into their windpipe, and they actually ended up having to have some minor surgery to really make sure that they were safe. So this is a problem for a lot of folks.
So this was some research and publication looking at finding the best ways to swallow pills and what strategies that we can recommend to make pill swallowing as easy as possible. And they came up with 143 patients taking 283 pills. They came up with two different approaches to taking medications. One of them is called the pop bottle method, where you fill the plastic bottle with water, put the tablet on the tongue, and then put your lips tightly around the opening of the bottle before drinking about a tablespoonful.
And the other one is called the lean forward method. And they recommended this for capsules. And their study was to look at which of these methods actually works best. And this is one where you put the capsule on your tongue. You take a sip of water. Don't swallow it yet. Then you bend the head forward, tilt your chin down, and then swallow it with the head bent forward. And that maybe seems a little counterintuitive for some folks, but apparently this helped push things back to the back of the throat. This was published in the Annals of Family Medicine. And I think a take-home principle is that you really do need to find the best way of swallowing pills. It's not just like, one way works best for everyone.
Right. And I also think this is just very practical research that applies to a lot of people. And so I'm glad that we're talking about it today.
You know what this research should be called, Christy?
What?
Just a spoonful of water makes those pills go down. What do you think?
I think it's great.
Without the singing.
You should sing every day. Okay, let's talk about
singing. These next two studies are ones I would be willing to sing about if we could get the right tune here, because they're really important research.
Yes. Okay, this first one that we're talking about is about an internet program that spurs 5.5 kilograms of weight loss. So that's, times 2.2, it's a little over, 12, 13 pounds of weight loss. By using an online internet program.
Yeah, this was a article, that research that was published in the journal Diabetes Care Appropriate, and there were 154 patients who were anywhere from mildly overweight to really morbidly overweight. The great majority of them were women, and they had two different possibilities they could have been doing. One was this group where they watched an interactive video, and then they reported their daily calorie, exercise, and body weight and got feedback, and the other group just got a newsletter. Didn't sound like a whole lot of intervention.
And the bottom line is that at 3 months, 53% of the program participants had lost 5% of their body weight, and almost half of them met that target at 6 months. And that was significantly different than the people in the control group who just sort of got some weekly newsletters.
Yeah. So there's no side effects from this. This is a good opportunity to really focus on really losing weight in a very inexpensive way. A different way of being aware of the problem is our last research that matters, which is an article that was in the journal Lancet Diabetes and Endocrinology about really bringing home what is the impact of excess weight on your health.
And this, when we say this, it sounds like wah-wah, obesity shortens life expectancy. And
well, I didn't say that.
This study, well, you feel like it, that it shortens life expectancies for up to 8 years. But thankfully, we've got some research coupled with this showing that you can make a difference and lose weight.
Yeah, they looked at research from the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey to come up with a model, a way of helping estimate how likely is it that with your level of weight are you going to get diabetes or heart disease, and looking at over 4,000 different individuals, and they really found out that you could lose up to 8 years of life if you were really obese, if morbidly obese, if you were simply obese, 6 years, and if you're overweight, 3 years. I think this is important research because I think a lot of people will really do want to see what their risk is and what they can do to lessen their own risk.
Right. And maybe it'll help more people pay attention. And as we discover more elements that could prevent obesity, and especially in our children going forward, and can make a difference as our previous study, then we have some hope to couple with that reality.
Well, that'll conclude the research that matters. Christy, we'll take a short break. When we return, we're going to be talking with Dr. Reed Blackwelder, president of the American Academy of Family Physicians, about being a family physician in the 21st century. As we go to break, you're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, and just a spoonful of water makes the medicine go down. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and my guest co-host, Dr. Alda Metzger, for this interview with really one of the great leaders in the discipline of family medicine, Dr. Reed Blackwater, president of the American Academy of Family Physicians, about being a family physician in the 21st century.
Welcome, Dr. Blackwelder.
Thank you so much, Autumn and Adam. It's wonderful to be here, and I really appreciate the invitation.
You know, Dr. Blackwater, we've known each other for a long time, and I can say honestly that one of the highlights of the last couple years was to see your progression to become president of the American Academy of Family Physicians. Tell us, though, for our listeners, tell us a little bit about how you got interested in family medicine, and how did that path take you into the highest leadership posts in the discipline?
Well, it's interesting. I was one of those people who did not always want to be a physician. It was actually not something I had planned until I was halfway through Haverford College, majoring in molecular biology, and I went, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? And I had worked at Grady Hospital before and realized the power that physicians had in really making a difference, but also sometimes in not helping, and I wanted to do something different. So I sort of followed my heart and went through the back door into medical school, went back to Atlanta and Emory. And the transformation really started when you and I met in Augusta at Medical College of Georgia. I was working with amazing family physicians, and I began to see the power of the relationship and the connections that you had with people, and even in the three-year residency. At the same time, I also discovered I love to teach, and I like to work with folks, and in fact stayed on an extra year to do some of that. So after Medical College of Georgia, I went and I wanted to stay in Georgia, and I did a National Health Service Corps clinic in Trenton, Georgia, a town of 1,400. And it was an incredible eye-opening experience. I had grown up in Atlanta and Philadelphia, very large cities, and I suddenly was in truly a small town with no traffic light, and I was the only physician for 2.5 years. And I realized that I became this community's, not just physician, but healer. I became a really important part of people's lives. I did home visits. I created a hospital practice. And I really, I fell in love with being part of a community and part of a larger family. And I know there's so many stories of just the different experiences I had there. One brief one is I went to see a patient of mine on a home visit. And this was one of the first home visits I'd made in Trenton. And so when I got there, the door opened, and there were 8 elderly women because this was her church group. And she was so excited to have the physician come that we sat in, and I ended up having tea and cake, sitting around talking to 8 women. And I guess we kind of did the home visit, but it was just one of those things where you realize how important your role is in a community.
And you probably got 8 more patients.
Oh, my gosh. The fun part about being the only physician is you really took care of everybody. And interestingly enough, that was when I also recognized how a community would come together and do a patient-centered medical home, which is a very common term used nowadays and a very important acronym about where we need to be heading. But at that time, we didn't have the acronym. But I had a health department, I had an EMS station, I had a pharmacy, I had a physical therapy office, I had 2 chiropractors, and we all took care of our community. And we'd actually do these weird things, like pick up the phone and talk to each other. It's kind of odd. But this was in the day before we had electronic records. And we communicated, we coordinated, and we gave care for our community because it was the right thing to do. I loved being a small town family physician. It was absolutely an amazing job. But the thing that was missing is that at that time, there were no medical schools and no residencies nearby. Now, Trenton was near Chattanooga, Tennessee, but there were no training programs there. And I really, really missed that. And a friend of mine from medical school was a surgeon in Kingsport, and he said, you need to come check this place out. It's in northeast Tennessee. And I went and met some amazing people and decided that I needed to come back so I could work with medical students and family medicine residents, at the same time taking care of my own patients and doing full-scope family medicine. And that's really what led me into the job change. But throughout this time, I had also recognized that there were problems in medicine and real significant challenges, and there were systems issues that needed to be addressed. And one of the things you have to do, and we say this at the Academy, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. And there were so many things happening that I wanted to be a part of those discussions. So some time ago, as a medical student and then as a resident, I got involved in the American Academy of Family Physicians early on. And I was on commissions and I did work. And then when I left Georgia to go to Tennessee, I got a chance to be involved. And that allowed me to work through the state leadership, which is the really most critical first step, because so much of politics is local. But I wanted to do more and had an opportunity to be part of the delegation from Tennessee to the national meetings. And over time, I found myself with the chance to run, and 5 years ago ran for the board of directors and was successful. I got to work with some amazing people and decided to run for president-elect, and now about to finish my president year and begin my year as chair, and then that will have completed a really incredible run in the politics of medicine.
Well, really, really, really glad that you decided that.
Yeah, it sounds like it's been an adventure thus far, for sure.
No, it's been phenomenal.
After you've been a physician for many years now and gotten to practice in a variety of settings, especially between your rural practice and medical education, and in your mind now looking at medical education, how have things changed since you entered the field? Where do you kind of see those things going, and are there still some areas of shortcoming that we need to be working on and towards?
There really are. I think the challenge for medical education, there's a global challenge, and that is to find a way to ensure that our medical schools actually graduate the workforce this country needs. And I'm encouraged because at this point, we're hearing a lot of discussion of primary care, and that's general internal medicine, general pediatrics, and family medicine. But family physicians are really the group that tend not to subspecialize. We stay in primary care, even though we have some other options. Sadly, our medical schools really are only graduating, even our best medical schools are only graduating 23 or 24% of their class into family medicine. And our workforce, we have about 30% in this country who are primary care, when the rest of the world is usually closer to 60, 65%. So we have sort of a backwards ratio. So that is probably one of the most important areas that needs to change, is finding a way to help incentivize primary care as a specialty choice for our students and to make sure that our medical schools are really working to meet the social mission.
So what I know that the Academy has a long track record of trying to encourage and move and facilitate those types of choices. What over the last year have you seen working or not working, and how do we fix it?
Well, I'm going to jump to the how do we fix it, because we have done a lot of work and have some good ideas of the kinds of things that can incentivize a process. And we just had a very important summit on Capitol Hill that I was a part of. Actually, all the chair, the president-elect, along with some of our staff, were present on Capitol Hill to do a briefing on our suggestions for graduate medical education. And this was in follow-up to the recent Institute of Medicine report. And a lot of it was really getting down into some of the specific details about how we currently pay for medical school and resident education. And that some of those changes, and it's both. It's medical school, but it's also resident. We have to make sure we have enough residency spots and how we pay for that, but also how we finance aspects of medical school to increase those going into primary care. Some of it has to address the salary gap and the medical student debt load, and that right now, unfortunately, we have a healthcare system that emphasizes paying for procedures, fee-for-service, over the cognitive work that we do in family medicine especially. And we need to make some changes in how we pay for the care and how we value the different, that shift. So, and happy to, I know we don't have as much time as I always like in these discussions, but we have some links on our website about some of the recommendations we've made for changes.
Yeah, we'll definitely put those links up there.
I appreciate that. I think the other component that's really critical, and it goes back on where we need to go, and this is a very important discussion. None of us are independent. and this is tough. I was a small solo family physician, but the word solo almost implies that it was just me and that was it. And the reality was, I've already described, I had a team of other providers and professionals around me. We weren't in the same office and we weren't contracted together. We just took care of our community and our patients. And that's really what we need to be emphasizing in our medical school education, our residency education, and in how we provide for our patients. We need to have newer ways of ensuring that patients get, the way we summarize it, is the right care, right place, right time from the right person. Because so much of medical care right now is patients who are not covered by insurance with critical issues showing up in emergency rooms or hospitals at the end stage. And we need to be shifting our emphasis toward true prevention and primary care. And we have to do that in creative ways. None of us are alone. And we can't all do everything. We have to find the ways of ensuring that different team members are providing what patients need. And this really changes how we educate our students and our residents. It's a different model. We live in a day where you can Google anything on your smartphone and get some of the facts that, Adam, you and I learned way back when in residency. We'd have to pull out these things called textbooks and flip through pages and find things. Now you can find something instantly. But how you use that information, how you think clinically, and how you prioritize is a different skill set. And that's the challenge for medical education. How do we begin to continue to advance that kind of education over just information distribution?
Well, Dr. Bodwell, I completely agree with you, and especially as someone who's just recently been in medical school and see some of those movements actually happening. We need to take a short break, but when we return, we'll continue with talking with our doctor guest, Dr. Reed Blackwelder, president of the American Academy of Family Physicians, about being a family physician in the 21st century. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Autumn Metzger.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Autumn Metzger. And we're talking with Dr. Reed Blackwelder, president of the American Academy of Family Physicians, about being a family physician in the 21st century. And Dr. Blackwelder, you know, it's really an amazing journey that you've described for yourself and the communities that you serve, leading into leadership in the American Academy and talking about the educational reforms. Let's talk about the healthcare reforms that have gripped the country over the last 4 years and that you, over the last year, I'm sure have been at the center of so many discussions. Let's talk about the Affordable Care Act and being a family physician in the 21st century. Where do you start?
Well, I think probably one place you start is that the whole issue of healthcare reform is critical because our country spends more per capita per year on healthcare than any other developed country in the world. We're spending currently over $8,000 per person, and some of the other comparison countries are $2,000 to $3,000. And yet our numbers for outcomes, all the things that are important to patients, our numbers are about 37th. We're really not getting the most bang for our buck. And this is why there was this recognition of primary care as a true foundation need, that every other country that spends less and has better outcomes has a primary care base, and this country has a proceduralist base. So much of the advocacy and the reform really starts with that. The two factors that are most critical in ensuring better outcomes for patients, and we have this in the research, is having insurance coverage, but also having a routine source of comprehensive continuity care, and that really is sort of defining primary care. So these are the two factors that we need, and that's one reason that healthcare reform tried to move forward providing coverage where patients didn't have it. Sadly, even if it had been fully implemented and fully funded without controversy, the Affordable Care Act would still have left 20 million people uninsured. So we still have an issue that needs our attention. And this issue is not just nationally, it's state. Because, for example, expanding Medicaid has been a real controversial issue. I like to, when I have these discussions, point out these are not patients that are standing on the sidelines just waiting to get insurance and then they'll play the game. They're already involved. They're showing up in our emergency rooms, our urgent care centers, our hospitals. And again, this is wrong care, wrong place, wrong time. So we as communities, and it's state by state, and sometimes it's like small towns like mine in Trenton, Georgia, where there needs to be an effort by the physicians to become involved. You do not have to become president of the AAFP, but I think there is an obligation to be a role model and a leader in your community. And when you're opening your practice, meet with your community, find out what their needs are. It may not be insurance coverage. It may need to be a change in the hours you offer, the procedures you offer. For example, when I was in Trenton, Georgia, one of the needs was that there was no connection with the hospital. When my patients needed to be admitted, they'd go and see some other physician, and they'd come back, and I may or may not get a note. I decided to create a hospital practice so that when my patients got sick, I would admit them, and I would go round on them in Fort Oglethorpe, Georgia, and see what was going on. I knew the kind of care, and I knew how to coordinate it and to try to give them improved care, lower cost, lower duplication. These kinds of things have to be from discussions that people have within their communities. All politics is local is the starting point.
Great.
So that's one of the first things I think people need to look at is what's needed where you live.
Great.
Absolutely. So one of the things I've been wondering a little bit about as we talked about the Affordable Care Act, but also kind of the discussion we had previously in terms of you being in rural medicine and having enough primary care providers as a whole in a country, in our country, and the shortage that we do have, is how do we get primary care providers and other providers really to the places of need? So we have a shortage in numbers in general, but how do we get them out there? And are there things under the Affordable Care Act or in policy right now that are happening to help do that?
And that the American Academy can really have some unique influence.
Mm-hmm. It's a great question. And the good news is that family physicians already go to rural areas and go to underserved. And we have data showing that even with all the challenges that we are there. Now, we could do better. But we also need to take advantage of new resources such as telemedicine and telehealth to reach patients who may not be able to get in even to rural practices. There are patients who have difficulty with access. So those are areas of current advocacy. How do we figure out ways of tapping into the newer technology and create that accessibility for patients? And they have to be established patients. You really need to have a relationship in order to take advantage of that. We need to keep pushing for ways of valuing primary care. And the Affordable Care Act put in a couple of very important components that were a start towards shifting our country toward paying for value away from fee-for-service. One was the Medicaid-Medicare parity. So when you see a Medicaid patient, we're currently, until the end of this year, you're still paid on the same rate as Medicare. And it's important because Medicaid traditionally pays about two-thirds of Medicare throughout the country, some places worse. And it's very hard for patients with Medicaid to see physicians because of that payment challenge. And this, unfortunately, is sunsetting at the end of this year. So that's an area of strong advocacy for our academy, but also state by state. And some states have already implemented legal change to make that a permanent change. So those are the kinds of efforts that can bear fruit on a state-by-state basis. Other states, and Tennessee is one of them, is still struggling with, do you expand Medicaid or not? The other aspect that was part of the ACA that directly valued primary care was the primary care bonus payment. So if you met certain criteria and were, like I was, a small-town family physician, you would get paid 10% addition for all your Medicare patients. And that was a very substantial improvement that was a step in the right direction. Unfortunately, that also sunsets at the end of next year. And so family physicians right now are faced with potential loss of Medicaid, Medicare parity. And right now, a lot of family physicians are seeing, 13-14% Medicaid. My current practice sees 36% Medicaid. And then we could lose the primary care bonus of 10% in another year, and each year we're getting a 10% cut on Medicare because of the sequester. So I bring those up because those are three very important ways that were steps in the right direction to valuing primary care, to incentivize students into going into primary care specialties, but they're in danger. And so at a time when we need a primary care workforce, the country has to figure out how do we continue to move forward and not suddenly take several steps back, because I'm afraid that will create some really significant access challenges for our patients.
You know, we're going to have to wrap up in just a second, but I think it'd be remiss, Dr. Blackwater, if I didn't mention that you have done the walking the walk and talking the talk. You've done them both, and you were an advocate in when times and places in the country as a family doctor working for tobacco prevention and tobacco cessation through a doctor and doctors ought to care at a time in which it was not popular, and taking positions that often perhaps were ahead of the time. And I think we should need to thank you for that leadership and perhaps taking some positions now that may not necessarily be fully popular, but perhaps are ahead of their time.
Well, thank you very much for that. And again, it's an honor to serve, and it's truly humbling to see what communities and family physicians are going through right now. And I just applaud everyone who's really in the trenches and walking their talk in very powerful ways for their patients. And thank you for what you two are contributing as well, because this is a big part of getting information out and creating change.
We've been talking with Dr. Reed Blackwelder, President of the American Academy of Family Physicians, about being a family physician in the 21st century. We want to thank you for being our guest and wish you well in all the next phases.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you both, and keep doing this great work.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Alda Metzger. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. And Christy, we just had such a nice conversation with one of our resident physicians, with Dr. Reed Blackwelder. And, you know, I think it's really nice to hear from the national leadership at the American Academy about issues that affect all of our listeners' health across the United States and beyond.
No, I appreciate that conversation, and I'm glad to join you for the House Call segment of our show today, where we get to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
If you'd like us to address one of your health questions on an upcoming show, send it to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our executive producer, Erica Norrie, to read us our very first House Call question today.
My husband and I would like to adopt a child, as we are now 40 and it doesn't look like we can become pregnant given our medical workup and things we have tried. He has diabetes, however, it's well controlled. The adoption agency said if his lifespan is shortened, this may make it impossible to adopt. Does this seem right?
Wow, that is a tough, tough question.
It is a tough question, and that seems unusual for someone to be limited in their ability to adopt due to something, a chronic condition like diabetes.
No, I've heard that, Christy, that a lot of times, you know, if you think about it, you know, if someone has cancer, for instance, would you allow them to adopt a child? And so I
do think there are circumstances where patients who have cancer in remission are able to adopt children.
Right. But I think there's this question, and I've seen this on forums before, that asks the doctor to certify that a patient's going to have a normal lifespan. And I think that's a difficult thing for a doctor and puts us actually in a really difficult situation, because there's so many different illnesses that might make you, for instance, being overweight, that we talk about a lot on this show. That could impact people's lifespan. And does that preclude you from adopting? I think we would say, no, that's ridiculous. That shouldn't preclude you. But so how do you answer this question?
Right. Well, and then the broader thing is that there are so many children out there who need adoption. And I would encourage you to look outside that particular agency, consider local adoption, consider international adoption, continue to pursue that, because if you have love to give and the ability to raise children, that's an important gift, and a lot of children out there need you.
And if your husband has diabetes that's well controlled, I would, you know, myself, I would be willing to put that on the form. You know, the diabetes, all these health problems are really well controlled.
Yeah.
So work with a physician also that's willing to work with you on this one.
Mm-hmm. Let's take our next House Call question.
My family doctor told me that I have mitral valve prolapse and I shouldn't worry because I don't have any symptoms. But my mother seems to think I need to take antibiotics before I have a dental procedure. Who is right?
Well, it depends. Is the answer.
we want to make both people happy here.
So, previously, it used to be very, very common that anybody who had even a mild mitral valve prolapse was advised to take antibiotics before medical procedures. But more recently, it's been sort of more attention given to how severe that mitral valve prolapse is. So if it's moderate or severe, then the antibiotics may be appropriate. But if it's just mild mitral valve prolapse, which a lot of people have without any real significance, then those antibiotics may not be necessary.
Yeah, you know, a lot of doctors or even providers, you know, they could be operating off the wrong set of guidelines, and that's been communicated to the public. So, but in 2007, the American Heart Association really issued new guidelines about who really needs to take it, and it really narrowed down a lot. And so those really are those who are undergoing the highest risk medical procedures that may result in, you know, bacteria in the blood, along with if you've got significant mitral valve prolapse, with the great majority of people do not.
Exactly.
So this is not an issue that, for the most part, but I do commend your mother for being aware of this, and we'd encourage you to talk to your doctor about it.
That is right. Let's take our next house call question.
I'm a young woman of 33, mother of two children, and happily married, and happen to hold down a good job.
Good for you.
I've been tired all the time for months now. I went to see my doctor, and they didn't think I was depressed, but chronically sleep-deprived. I currently sleep about 6 hours a night, but the doctor recommended that I sleep a minimum 8 to 9 hours. I try to catch up on the weekends, but how on earth do I find time during the days when I have no time?
Wow, 6 hours a night is really not very much.
Yeah, I, you know, this is one of those situations where I really want to help you. I really want to create about 3 more hours in your day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let's have 27-hour days, and then you could say you get 3 more hours. But the simple fact is, if you're not getting enough sleep, you're not going to be able to ultimately do all these other things, and the fatigue will continue. Now, maybe there's some other factors involved, about you could have sleep apnea or some other things that could be impacting on your sleep patterns. But you've got
like busyness.
You got to create the space for sleep, because sleep is so restorative.
Well, and let me say, if you can afford it and you have the opportunity, if you have family members who can help you, or if you can hire a babysitter or give yourself some help. When you have two parents with two children, both working jobs, that's a lot of stuff to do to keep everyone tended to and to do your jobs and to also sleep. So it might mean that you need some extra help doing some of the household chores or doing some other things if you can find those resources.
Yeah, Christy and I have talked, and I think we've become convinced more than ever about the importance and the scientific research that shows optimum sleep relating to so many, not only emotionally, but physical health issues and longevity of things that really matter to people. So we would encourage you to work with your provider, work with your social networks, work with a therapist, help get more sleep.
Mm-hmm. Let's take our very last house call question.
I've been taking testosterone for a long time. I stopped recently, and my doctor said it wasn't truly indicated, but it could increase my chance of a heart attack, which runs in my family. My sex life has gone down the toilet. This is one of those circumstances where I may have thrown the baby out with the bathwater. Any help would be appreciated.
Well, Christy and I don't know how often, Christy, but I do hear this a lot. Men are talking with me a fair amount about problems with sexual desire, and a lot of them are on testosterone, and maybe they've been told at some point in time that their testosterone was low, and yet there's more and more research, and we've talked about on the show, about some of the concerns and harms, and so someone with a family history of heart attacks, you know, it's quite reasonable to not take the testosterone.
Well, I think it's reasonable to not take the testosterone, yes, but I also think that if as you weigh that out, this problem with your sexual function and you feel like it's better when you're on it, you have to sort of weigh out your specific risk around the heart disease stuff and your quality of life and sexual health and other elements that are important to you as well. And so there's not an absolute right or wrong here, as with many questions, but something that you have to weigh out around your specific health and your values.
You know, one of the things that Christy and I talked about some research a couple months ago was about lifestyle factors actually having as big of an impact as most medications on sexual functioning. So if you were overweight, losing weight, if you smoked, quit smoking, if you weren't exercising, start exercising, if you're not getting enough sleep, getting more sleep, really taking a more holistic approach mm-hmm. rather than just necessarily a shot approach to sexual function, and perhaps even meeting with a sex therapist and approaching, again, different modalities here, which I would encourage you. There's almost nothing to be lost by trying some of these other things.
Completely agree. Thanks for your question on tackling a difficult topic. And thanks to all of our listeners for joining us today for Your Health. We hope we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to your health. And we want you to share your questions, share your stories by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or get our health app at the App Store.
We'd like to thank the University of North Carolina Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, for their sponsorship. Our guest today, Dr. Reed Blackwelder, and having Dr. Alda Metzger, who was available for that interview. And we hope you'll join us again next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.